Today's episode of Dog Nation Daily is brought to you by Meriwether and Tharp, your source for Georgia divorce. Find them online at theatlantadivorceteam.com.
Presented by DogNation.com, this is Dog Nation Daily, the daily podcast for Georgia Bulldogs fans. Here's your host, Brandon Adams.
Every now and then on the show, I kind of talk about something I'm not necessarily proud of. I show a side of my personality that I'm not necessarily proud of. This is probably one of those moments because I'm going to be very spiteful for a couple of minutes. But in a lot of ways, this is really in keeping with the typical college football fan, I believe. And what I'm about to say, you may not agree with. But I think if you think about it long enough, you'll at least kind of understand where I'm coming from. I think there's an aspect of a good number of college football fans, maybe even the majority, where they almost like seeing their hated rival suffer more than they enjoy watching their favorite team win. Doesn't seem like that should be true, but at times it almost feels like it is. And admittedly, even for me sometimes, watching my most hated rival, speaking as a Georgia fan, that's the Florida Gators, watching them go through hard times, I won't say it's better than watching my team on top of the mountain, but it is almost at times, unfortunately, and I'm not proud of this, I'm not proud to say this is true, but unfortunately, it almost feels true that watching them have a bad moment is almost as enjoyable as experiencing my favorite team having a good moment. So with that in mind, let me say this. As a Gator hater, and I probably pride myself in being the chief Gator hater in many respects, we do the Gator Hater Updater, counting down the number of days since Florida last beat Georgia. We do that on the show every single day. I think my Gator hater credentials are well established at this point in time. And as someone who loves beating up on, as I like to call them, the lousy stinking Gators, each of the last 3 years, 2017, 2018, 2019, each of the last 3 years of Georgia beating Florida has been, oh, so sweet, oh, so enjoyable. Asking me to choose between those three wins in terms of which one I like the best is almost like asking me to choose between my children in terms of the unconditional love you give to them. I can't pick between the 17 game, which was a total blowout, the 18 game, which was the first time Georgia got a chance to slap around Dan Mullen, the 19 game, the game I think the Florida thought it had a legitimate chance to win, only to be kind of jerked away from Georgia, almost like Lucy with the football with Charlie Brown. Each of those games had their own distinct storylines and narrative. Choosing which one was the most enjoyable, very, very difficult to do. However, I would submit to you that if and when Georgia goes on to win against Florida for a fourth straight year this year on Halloween of 2020, I believe that this will be the most enjoyable win for Georgia against Florida yet in the Kirby Smart era, and I want to lay out exactly why I think that's true. By now, you know what the dominant discussion point amongst many Florida fans is the reason they believe that they'll see their team and their coach, Dan Mullen, eventually topple Kirby Smart in Georgia is they simply believe that Mullen is just the better game coach, the smarter X's and O's game day coach than Kirby Smart. And the fact there is literally no moment in Mullen's coaching career against Kirby Smart where he's proven this to be true, that doesn't stop them from still believing that. Absent of any evidence to support the claim whatsoever, Florida fans just march right along believing this to be true. And one of the reasons why that's allowed to persist as a talking point amongst the Gators is because of the fact that the media seemingly likes touting this there as well. I don't believe the media has an agenda on this. I just think they've been fooled by Mullen. The media loves the notion of a coach who does more with less. And that's what Dan Mullen, to his credit, did a lot of at Mississippi State. I've compared this before to the independent film that, you know, makes some noise during the Academy Award season time, or the hot indie band that, you know, you like before they started having their songs played on the radio. There's a certain element of that when it comes to Dan Mullen of it's easy to call Nick Saban the best coach in the SEC, more interesting to make the case for Mullen back when he was at Mississippi State. So some of that still exists in the mind of a lot of the media who discusses this sport for a living. They just think Dan Mullen to be a good coach. I believe that they are in error, at least to the degree to which they proclaim this to be true, but it's kind of easy to understand where it comes from. It's not necessarily an anti-Georgia bias or even a pro-Florida bias. It's maybe just a boredom with the status quo more so than anything else. But because the media touts it, says things about Dan Mullen, it gives Florida fans, I think, the false sense of security that Dan Mullen's on his way to just absolutely top toppling the bully of the SEC East, Kirby Smart. And if you don't believe that I'm true, but what the media has said about this, let's go back to last year. Reese Davis, the host of ESPN's College Game Day, a guy that I really like, a guy who I think of as a really fun voice in the sport of college football, a true legit fan of this sport, someone who would watch the games even if he wasn't paid to, and then who brings that passion for the sport onto TV. I can't say enough good things about Reese Davis. He's kind of an SEC guy, Alabama grad, I believe. He brings some SEC sensibility to his role there at ESPN. But he was flat wrong this past season when he said this about Dan Mullen.
But I'm sure that there are play callers in the country who are Dan Mullen's equal, but I'll take him up against anybody. I think there's no one that is clearly better. Mm-hmm. He has a great sense of timing, whether it's a trick play or setting up a play and so forth. And it's benefited the Gators greatly a couple of times when they couldn't block the opposing offensive or defensive front, especially in that Auburn game.
So I think that Reese Davis is emblematic of how a lot of the media feels about Mullen. They truly, legitimately, as honestly as they can express themselves, think that Mullen's a really good coach. When they say things like that, Florida fans who are preconditioned to think that anyway only become all that much more ardent believers in the cult of Dan Mullen as an on-field coach who designs an offensive game plan that's impossible to stop. And eventually that's going to come to bear at Florida. They're going to beat Georgia, and as some have predicted this offseason, and get into the college football playoff, which is why this season's win against Florida, when it comes for Georgia, will be the most enjoyable yet. And it's not just because it'll be beating Florida in a year in which Florida thinks it has a real chance to do something. The truth is, that's what Georgia accomplished last season. No. What would make a Georgia win against Florida so much fun and so special this year is the narrative that you just heard Reese Davis express and the one that Florida fans have bought into. Boy, at that point in time, it's almost like you have to put that to bed forever. You can never say that again after this year if Georgia has the better team, especially if Georgia has the better offense. I'll tell you what led me to think this. I was looking at Athlon Sports. That's a website that I like, and they do a lot of college football off-season content, and they were previewing the 2021 draft, next year's draft. And they were looking at the top quarterbacks in the NFL draft for next season. And in a lot of the mock drafts you've seen from ESPN, CBS, other places like that, you've seen Jamie Newman as a first rounder. We'll see if Newman ends up playing that well. In this particular Athlon draft, though, they weren't ranked by, you know, when they're expected to be drafted or the order they'll be picked. They were just put in alphabetical order. But Jamie Newman was right there almost alongside Kyle Trask. And seeing those two names so close together on this list of draft eligible quarterbacks for next season got me to thinking, you know, Florida seemingly has it all lined up perfectly. They bring back Kyle Trask, and we've heard some talk during the offseason that Trask is the best returning quarterback in the SEC. He's certainly one of the few returning starters from the top teams in the league right now. This ought to be Trask's year. This ought to be the kind of quarterback that Dan Mullen can really make some magic with. But what if Kirby Smart takes a graduate transfer from Wake Forest, brings in an offensive coordinator, Todd Monken? The one knock on Smart right now has been his hesitation, his resistance to the offensive wave that's obviously sweeping through the rest of the country. But what if that's no longer true after this year? What if Smart also adopts his own brand of innovative offense, much the same way LSU did a year ago? What if he takes Jamie Newman, the kind of guy that a lot of Florida fans on the basis of message boards don't seem to have a ton of respect for? What if Newman outplays Trask, not just in October in the cocktail party when these two teams get together, but for the season overall? At that point in time, what does Florida still have to tout about Dan Mullen? At that point in time, what can Mullen tout about himself, and what can the media tout on his behalf? Won't all the things that Florida fans have used to sell themselves on Mullen being the future of their program, won't all of that be rendered moot if Newman outplays Trask, if Georgia's offense in 2020 is better than Dan Mullen's after what Florida has seemingly been trying to build towards over the course of the last few years, which is why, as I said, I'm not proud of how spiteful I am sometimes, but as a fan, that would make beating Florida this year for Georgia even sweeter than any of the last three. Now, it's worth pointing out that when it comes to that head-to-head chess match style matchup between Kirby Smart and Dan Mullen, at least publicly when Smart's spoken about this, he's expressed a lot of respect for Mullen and the kind of offense that he's capable to build. So while maybe I don't have as much respect for Mullen as some of the media does, certainly Smart seems to. But there was one thing in particular that Smart said about Mullen last year that I think in the context of what we now know about how Florida finished the 2019 season makes what Smart said in a complimentary fashion about Mullen all the more interesting. Let me let you go back and hear Kirby Smart here for a moment.
It's a chess match. Every time you go against somebody, it boils down a lot more to players than it does X's and O's. He always has a very physical football team. They believe and they have a commitment to the run game. They always seem like they have downhill, low center of gravity backs, very similar to what he has now. He had at Mississippi State, big physical offensive line. He never abandons the run. He's always going to be able to run the ball. He always has a quarterback that can run the ball, especially whether it's short yardage or packages with Emory coming in for him. And he's got as good a wideout group that he's ever had that I can remember, and he's using those guys' skill sets. I mean, he highlights those wideouts he has because he has so many. I mean, I don't know how to better say it than to say that he has a complete offensive package right now with what he has, so he has the ability to use all those guys.
So those words by Smart meant to be complimentary. But when you think about the specifics of a couple things that Smart says there, kind of gets your attention. He says, hey, listen, the one thing I know about Dan Mullen, he always has an offense that can run the football. However, last year, by the end of the season, Florida was just 13th in the SEC in rushing. Kirby Smart says Dan Mullen's always got a quarterback that contributes to that running game. Certainly Dak Prescott once did at Mississippi State. Tim Tebow once did when Mullen was the offensive coordinator at Florida. How's Kyle Trask doing in that regard? And Smart says, well, that's when they have special packages for Emory Jones. Yeah, but how much of those special packages can be employed if Florida, like everybody else, has dealt with the absence of a spring practice? It seems at least fair to wonder on that. Kirby saying of last year's Florida team, the best crop of wide receivers that probably Mullen's ever had at his disposal. That's probably true. That's a good wide receiving core last season. We said as much before those two teams played last year. Van Jefferson's gone. It's a little bit different kind of story for the Gators at wide receiver this upcoming season. The point here is this. We're about to find out if Dan Mullen really is as good an offensive genius as some have proclaimed him to be, and Gators fans hope that he's going to be. And if somehow Kyle Trask gets outplayed by Jamie Newman, which is very likely to occur, if the Georgia offense led by Todd Monken eclipses statistically in contributing to wins, more so than what Florida does under Mullen, at that point in time, the narrative Mullen being some sort of unstoppable genius, that should probably be quieted down a bit after this season. My name's Brandon Adams, and this is Dog Nation Daily, the daily podcast for Georgia Bulldogs fans. We are presented today by our friends at Meriwether and Tharp, and we're glad to have you with us. And I will remind you that Meriwether and Tharp is your source for Georgia divorce. And let's face it, divorce is a tough topic, but unfortunately, it's a real topic. You know, the stats would bear it out. Of all the tens upon tens of thousands of people who listen to this podcast, you know, every single day, there are a number of you, unfortunately, probably dealing with this. It just stands to be true that a great number of people have either just gone through a divorce or find themselves about to go through a divorce. And if you find that stuff to be true, certainly my prayers go out to you, and I'm so sorry. But I can also give you some advice. You need a good, strong advocate on your side. That's what my friends at Meriwether and Tharp provide. They're your source for Georgia divorce. You can find them online at theatlantadivorceteam.com. That's theatlantadivorceteam.com. When it comes to your relationship with your children, when it comes to your relationship with your finances, when it comes to all of that, it can all be made whole again. But the process will require you having someone smart, someone who's got the earned experience of having been through this thousands of times. That's what my friends at Meriwether and Tharp provide. Find them online at theatlantadivorceteam.com. All right, in a moment, we're going to get Mike Griffith here today, and we'll talk about the Newman-Trask comparison a bit. I'm going to get more into some reporting you've seen at the Athens Banner-Herald about how Georgia, compared to, like, say, South Carolina and others, may be dealing with a social distancing reality for some fans in the stands for this upcoming season. It's an ongoing story. I think it's interesting. I think there's something the average beat writer just doesn't kind of get about this, about how controversial ticketing stuff is for fans in general. I may do some more on that before we're done on the show today. Trust me, if you are a fan at tailgates, you know, places where ticket buying Georgia fans get together, who gets access to the most tickets and the best tickets is always a hot, controversial topic. If you live your life in a press box, you don't probably quite understand them quite as well. But we'll talk about that a little bit on the show today. I'm also going to get into with Mike something that I thought was interesting from Steve Sarkisian, the Alabama offensive coordinator, tweeting out a graphic that had 24/7 Sports had contributed to, not the graphic, but just the stats on there about how well Alabama has done in terms of turning five-star signees into first-round draft picks, possibly painting the way forward for Georgia to live up to its billing and win a national championship soon and fully round out Kirby Smart's reputation as a coach as he enters into a year five. These are some pretty good stats, and we'll do more on that even after Mike is done with us here today. So we're really glad to have you with us. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show as Dog Nation Daily, presented by Meriwether and Tharp, rolls on right now.
From Athens and across the SEC or wherever the recruiting trail may lead, here's a DogNation.com insider.
With that said, I'll bring in Mike Griffith on this topic here for a moment, here on Dog Nation Daily, presented by Meriwether and Tharp. And Mike, do you understand where I'm coming from on this when it comes to Jamie Newman? Obviously, the jury is still out on how good he can be at Georgia. Certainly, there's some raw materials here that you can imagine UGA could use. But the one thing that some folks in the media, certainly plenty of Gators fans have said, is that eventually Mullen's coaching acumen, his brilliance on the offensive side of the ball, as they would describe, is going to be the thing that gives him the leg up against Kirby Smart. Well, this year, with him being one of the few programs in the SEC that brings back starting quarterback, at least of the top contenders, and for all the warm, rosy things that have been said about Trask, if Georgia rebuilds its offense around Jamie Newman, if Newman outperforms Trask, at that point in time, one of the key talking points for the Gators would seem to be greatly diminished at that point. Am I overstating things?
No, I don't think so. And I think the thing that they need to keep in mind is that, you know, whether or not Kyle Trask is a future NFL player or first rounder, we saw last year with Jake Fromm, it so much has to do with the supporting cast. You know, what kind of offensive line does he have? What type of running game? I mean, he lost LaMichael Perine. I believe he's got to replace some receivers. There's more to it than just the X's and the O's and the quarterback. And I think Georgia was a case in point for that last year.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And, you know, listen, when it comes to Florida, you know, obviously this is not a team that ran the football very well at all last season. And if you're going to compete in the SEC, that's something eventually you're going to have to do. And by the way, when you look at Mullen teams that have been successful, both as an offensive coordinator at Florida, as, you know, a head coach at Mississippi State, especially in 2014, the ability to run the football was something those teams put together. But last season, Dan Mullen almost defiantly anti-run, especially in the game against Georgia. He took some media heat for that at the end of the game. Hard for me to imagine, whether it's Kyle Trask or anybody else, Florida's building much in the way of a successful offense if they don't run the football better than they did a year ago. They do bring in Lorenzo Lingard, former five-star transfer, but that's still a running game that's very much, I think, open for debate at the moment.
Yeah, I think balance is the key. You know, I think you got to be able to take advantage of what your opponents don't do well, and conversely, try and stay away from it. I mean, Georgia, for example, had a much different game plan against LSU than they did against Kentucky, you know, and obviously elements had something to do with that. But, you know, I think that's where it gets back to the balance. And, you know, Florida, to me, when I look at their personnel, they're not there yet. And that's the biggest deal of them all. Do I think Dan Mullen is a good coach? Yes, I think he's a good coach. But like any other good coach, he has to have great players. And then beyond being a good coach and having great players, you've got to have a great staff and you've got to have some great – it takes a lot, B.A. We've seen it. I mean, you can have everything lined and still have something fluky happen that prevents you from winning championships.
I want to talk in a moment about a piece you've got coming up today at DogNation.com that may, for all I know, already be published. Before I get to that, though, Mike, I believe there is a storm brewing with UGA fans that's probably not going to get as much media attention as it probably should. Now, there's a very serious issue going on of what does football look like when it returns this fall. I believe in some form or fashion football is coming back, and how safe are people going to be? That's a serious topic for people more serious than me to deliberate. But let's assume for a moment, I know Ray Tanner, the South Carolina athletic director, has talked about this. There have been some other things written about. Athens Banner-Herald had some quotes from Greg McGarity about social distancing in college football. And there was a report in the Lexington, Kentucky paper the other day that, you know, you're talking about a stadium like Georgia potentially only able to house about 20,000 people if you're going to have 6 feet in between, you know, everybody in the stadium. Mike, if that's the case, if Georgia's trying to play games and there's a small number of fans, something in the neighborhood of, as has been kicked around, maybe it's only 15, 20,000, something like that, the debate over who gets to be that number, whatever the actual number ends up being, far fewer than the 93,000 capacity. The debate over who gets to be that number, assuming that's how all this plays out, is going to be quite contentious. Below the surface, the media doesn't cover this very much because it doesn't impact them, but below the surface, the battle amongst Georgia ticket holders, donors, about who gets priority seating is already a very hot topic. You cut the number of available seats almost, you know, one-fifth almost of the available seats. All of a sudden, at that point in time, I think it becomes even more intense than it already is. If this is the way this plays out, Mike, that is a storm brewing amongst UGA donors, UGA fans. And frankly, I am very glad that I don't have to be the one that has to solve that problem.
Yeah, it's going to be a battle everywhere. It's no different than the battle for bowl tickets or, you know, the battle. I'm sure there's only so many Georgia fans that can go to the Georgia-Florida game because that's not, you know, it's never in your home stadium, so you don't have 90,000 people there. But it's pretty simple. I mean, you're going to have your major donors there. I think the people with the skyboxes will have a different set of rules than the general admission, as we've seen with alcohol sales in the past. I don't expect that to change. That's more considered a private entity versus a public location. So I think the skybox people are taken care of. Then I think you've still got a lot of tickets to the student section because, after all, that is what college is all about. That is part of it. So I think that the students will still get their tickets. And then it just goes, it would seem to me, it just goes in order of the donations, just like it would bowl tickets. So I don't think there's much controversy there at all. You got to pay to play. And those that are willing to pay the most are going to get the tickets because the revenue revenue model is severely challenged right now. Beyond after the skyboxes and after the students BA, the student allotment, I think it'll absolutely be based on donations and donor level.
Well, keep in mind this, though. They're about, you know, there's a huge number of student tickets already allotted. So if you only choose students, in a sense, you fill the stadium with students alone. So at that point in time, if you start bringing in a lot of students, you're not making room for very many donors, which then sets up that sort of age-old battle that seems to go on in Georgia versus the people who have donated the longest compared to the people who've given the most. That always seems to be the sort of internal civil war amongst those tickets. And it is a hot topic amongst fans. I can promise you that.
Yeah. And I get it. You know, there is a lot of unease right now. Nobody's moving forward with a business as normal. As we talk about the new normal, as we talk about safe, you know, we hear the people, oh, is it going to be safe to be in the stadium? I don't know. Is it going to be safe to be at the mall? Is it going to be safe to be at the gas station? Is it going to be safe to be at the supermarket? I mean, that's the thing we always miss in this equation when everyone keeps talking about, we've got to make campus safe. I say, well, their community's not safe. I mean, I get groceries delivered at home. I mean, I could potentially get the coronavirus off a plastic bag as I could walking in the aisle. So the whole concept of safe and perfect solutions, you know, we all have to be tolerant and understand that there's going to be some uncomfortable decisions and things outside the norm waiting for us between now and the new normal.
Yeah. Ultimately, I'm just glad I'm not the one that has to make those decisions because, frankly, determining what is safe enough for people is certainly a tough choice right now. I'm glad it's not me that has to make that decision. A topic that I'm a lot more comfortable talking about as opposed to, you know, what football is going to look like when it returns is, assuming we have games, what the team itself will look like on the field. I know you've got a piece coming up at DogNation.com today. It may already be published for all I know. Where you look at Mel Kiper, his early big board for the 2021 draft, the seeming absence of Georgia players at the top end of this list in comparison to a program like Alabama that, after having, you know, a bunch of, you know, very high draft picks this past season, is in line for more of those this upcoming season. This to me is very similar to what I addressed with you last week, that if Georgia is going to win a national championship this season, then based on the recent results in the college football playoff era, the odds are that some top end draft talent has to emerge. And for the moment, I don't mean first round picks. I just mean first couple of day picks, players taken within the first three rounds. I told you last week that I believe that right now on paper, Georgia has likely four players to be drafted in the first three rounds of the NFL draft. But if you use LSU as your guide from a season ago, you probably need about five or six more of those to really be the best team in the country. And I think the Mel Kiper big board only reinforces what I told you last week, that there are some names not currently listed amongst the best at their positions on the Georgia roster that will have to emerge as so over the course of the season for Georgia to truly be a national championship team.
Oh, no question about it. Right now, the only players that are listed at the top five of their position by Mel Kiper Jr. are Monty Rice and Jamie Newman. I was surprised that Richard LeCount wasn't among the top five safeties. I was surprised not to see Tyson Campbell or Eric Stokes among the top five cornerbacks. I was surprised not to see Jordan Davis or Malik Herring among the top five defensive linemen, or Azeez Ojulari among the top five outside linebackers. Now, it's early. It's Mel Kiper's very first big board. I don't know how thoroughly or how deep he went into this, but the fact that there's 14 Alabama players listed among the top five at their position in the country and only two from Georgia, that's something that should be alarming, especially when you consider how well Georgia's recruited. And that's something that a lot of the Georgia rivals are pointing to if Kirby can't get a lot more guys drafted than he did last year off of his defense.
Well, what this brings to mind for me, and I'm doing more on this on our podcast edition of our show today, there was a recent tweet from Steve Sarkisian, the Alabama offensive coordinator, referencing a report from 24/7 Sports looking at how five stars have been developed in recent years. And according to 24/7 Sports, and Sarkisian tweeted this, about half the five stars that Alabama has brought in have ended up drafted in the first round during the Nick Saban era. That's far higher than the other programs in college football. And in fact, in some cases, almost double the college football average over the course of that time. Mathematically, those numbers don't quite mean, I think, what Sarkisian seems to think they mean. But it is an interesting point. When you look at draft-eligible former five stars for Georgia this year, it's names that we spoke about last week. It's Zamir White. It's Jamari Salyer. It's Tyson Campbell. It's Adam Anderson. When you look at guys who will be sophomores on this team this year that have a chance to be developed for the following NFL draft, it's Nolan Smith. It's N'Kobe Dean. It's Trayvon Walker. It's George Pickens. It's also Clay Webb, who we haven't seen as much of as of yet. But I do think it's fair to say to Georgia, to Kirby Smart, that if you want to fully form your coaching persona and if you want to put yourself in the best chance to win a national championship, then some of those names that I just mentioned, especially the guys for this year's draft-eligible class, Zamir, Jamari, Campbell, Anderson, from that group, a couple likely first-rounders have to emerge. And if you don't have that happen, then it will be fodder for negative recruiting. But more importantly, it'll be another year in which Georgia may have to settle for being second best in the SEC.
Yeah, it's kind of a slippery slope there, BA, because we talk about all these five stars that have to be picked. But then on the other hand, we want to give Kirby credit for developing a four star and Andrew Thomas and a three star and Solomon Kinley and getting them picked. So it's not like you can just say, well, the five stars have to make it. Sometimes the three stars come in and win those jobs, like Eric Stokes is a good example of that, a guy who wasn't highly recruited or highly ranked, I should say. So I don't get as much into that. I do understand why Alabama would float that. It looks good. If you're a five-star, you go, oh, my goodness, if I go to Alabama, I've got a better chance of being drafted. And really, for a lot of these kids, that's what it comes down to, is where do I have a chance to go to college that can get me paid and get me to the next level? Now, the name, image, likeness thing, BA, this is kind of interesting because this is going to get you paid a little bit sooner. And when you take a look at fan followings, you may get on the field sooner somewhere else. You may be able to talk as a freshman somewhere else. This equation is going to change beyond just where can I get to the NFL. There's going to be other factors. They're not just going to look at the stadium size or whether there's a waterfall in the locker room or whether there's a slide in the new football building. They're going to look at where their agent tells them they're going to get the most exposure and have the chance to earn the most revenue while they're still a player after fall of 2021.
Yeah, that's so far into the future for me. I can't quite process all that yet, but I do want to talk to you more about the draft part of this here in a moment. A couple more minutes with Mike Griffith. First of all, let me tell you about a great thing going on at Marlowe's Tavern. As we head towards Mother's Day, Marlowe's really working hard to make make Mother's Day special with some great to-go order options for either brunch or dinner. Now, if you order by 5 p.m. today, then you can either pick it up on Saturday or Sunday. You got great brunch options, great dinner options. The brunch includes, I love this, and this sounds so good, so much fun. If you're trying to make Mother's Day special for the mother in your life, how about some French toast casserole on the brunch menu? Or the dinner menu also includes braised short ribs. Really, really good stuff. Get your order in today by 5 p.m. Get ready to pick that up on either Saturday or Sunday and make Mother's Day special with to-go order options from our friends at Marlowe's Tavern. MarlowesTavern.com is the website to go to. Get that order in by 5 p.m. today, and then you can be ready to go with some great, great brunch and dinner to-go options as you get ready to celebrate Mother's Day this Sunday. And folks, don't forget that. It's a little D&D PSA. Do not forget to take care of your mother on Mother's Day. Social distancing doesn't absolve you from that responsibility, make sure you take care of that coming up here this weekend at Marlowe's Tavern. Certainly a great option to be able to do that. MarlowesTavern.com for more details on that. So go back to the topic of the draft here for a moment. Mike, you're right about the three stars that Smart has developed. I wrote about this at DogNation.com, that at times we pay so much attention to the top-end recruits that the way in which DeAndre Baker came through the program, sometimes that might get overlooked a little bit. Stokes has a chance to be another one of those guys in future years. Kinley was one of those guys this year. Kinley was a fourth-round pick, though, and I think that national championship teams are determined by how many first three-round picks they put together. As I said before, the Clemsons, the Alabamas, the LSUs, recent college football playoff champions have proven that. And so when I look at the story of the upcoming season for Georgia, I am looking at, well, who really blossoms and goes from being a good player to indisputably one of the top players in the country? Not only is that good for Georgia's overall program profile, I think it determines how likely Georgia is to win a game on the road in a place like Tuscaloosa or be a factor into a college football playoff conversation. Great teams are made up by a collection of top-end player performances, and I'm looking to see, can Georgia add a few more to the list of known commodities on that from where we sort of start the season right now?
Yeah, you know, Gene Stallings used to say, B.A., that you could look at any of the close games and it's usually decided by four or five plays, and you look at those four or five plays and it's usually two or three players. Obviously, quarterback is a central figure in all of this. But I think on defense, Richard LeCount is that guy. You know, we saw Richard really emerge the second half of last year as a playmaker, involved in some very key turnovers and wins over Auburn, as well as the two interceptions against Baylor in the Sugar Bowl. Really like what he made happen. Azeez Ojulari, I think we've talked about it, on whether it was on your show or whether it was on our Cover 4. You know, can he finish a lot of these plays that were quarterback pressures and turn them into sacks? He was one of the difference makers that we discussed. And I think we also talked about guys like Zamir White and, you know, obviously George Pickens. But I look to the receiving core and I say, who's number two and number three? And I keep throwing Matt Landers out there. And I know he's dropped a lot of opportunities, but he also made a catch in the Sugar Bowl. And I think he's got some momentum behind him. He's a guy that had better play well to get on the field to be quickly passed by some of these incomers. So I think you're absolutely right. You got to have some key position players emerge, especially at wide receiver. You'd like to see one of those running backs emerge and be dynamic. I don't think you've got a DeAndre Swift, but hopefully you've got somebody that's got the game-breaking speed. And then defensively, I think we talked about it last week, you know, disruptive plays, you know, more turnovers and sacks. So to your point, those are made by special players. And right now, Mel Kiper doesn't have them on the big board. And to me, that was a bit alarming.
Well, it's okay, I think, not to be there in the preseason. But if we don't see names on that list, all SEC draft list on the postseason, then something has probably gone wrong for UGA this year. Mike, thanks for being here on Dog Nation Daily, presented by Meriwether and Tharp. We'll look forward to reading a bunch from you at DogNation.com. And on this Thursday, we'll see you this afternoon at 3 p.m. for our Cover 4 broadcast, where you, me, Dog Nation's Connor Riley, our recruiting insider Jeff Sintel, we'll get together and talk about all things UGA this afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm certainly looking forward to doing that, and I'll look forward to seeing you then.
Thanks, B.A. Have a good one, man.
Let's take a look around the rest of the league. This is SEC Through.
I'm going to respond to a couple of things that we were talking about with Mike Griffith here in a moment as we roll through our SEC Through. I'll also remind you that, you know, we're still doing Dog Nation Daily live on video, or at least a version of it, a conversation together every morning at 10 a.m. And it includes our R.S. Andrews Cooldown, where you get a chance to share your comments on Facebook or YouTube. I'll respond to them. We'll have a really fun conversation about whatever's going on in UGA world. And, of course, R.S. Andrews can take care of your world there as well. You know, you're home a lot more. The last thing you want to do is stuck at home without working hot water. If you take a shower in the morning, it's not working. That stinks. That's awful. Well, R.S. Andrews can take care of you if you find that to be a trouble for you. In fact, any kind of plumbing or electrical issue, a heating and air conditioning issue, they can handle all those things. And as I said before, when it comes to a water heater, in many cases, if yours goes out, they can replace it same day. It's one of the reasons why that story after story, Dari and the whole team over there at R.S. Andrews have been delivering smiles. They can deliver one for you as well, but you've got to find them online. It's rsandrews.com. And please join us on Dog Nation Daily for our R.S. Andrews Cooldown every day on video as well. So a couple of things about what I was talking about with Mike. First of all, as I've said before, if you've lived your entire life in a press box as a writer, I think it's kind of hard to understand sometimes just how controversial the whole ticket thing is. And it's going to even be made even more controversial as if some of the reports that we've seen out there of greatly reduced seating capacity for stadiums this year comes to pass. It's still way too early to know how any of this is going to play out. And there are plenty of people kind of holding an optimistic tone that we have a lot of people, you know, maybe even full stadiums at some point in time. But, you know, you're always going to have the battle amongst Georgia fans between those who've given for a long time and been season ticket holders dating back decades. In fact, we had somebody in our Facebook comment section on video today say that he's been a season ticket holder for 46 years, and he'd like to see a little bit of loyalty from UGA. That's a pretty common refrain from those who've given the appropriate amount over the course of a long period of time in comparison to the people who are like, say, McGill Society members, and that's obviously been an important organization in terms of raising money for Georgia, but because they get a little bit of a status multiplier for the money they give inside McGill, that has been controversial for a lot of UGA fans who don't achieve McGill Society status. And, you know, frankly, who does deserve to be taken care of better? Those who've been loyal through decades in which Georgia football wasn't always the hot ticket in town, or those who've started giving a lot more here recently? I'm not sure. By the way, the McGill folks kind of complain about the fact that even though they're giving a lot of money, because the best seats in Sanford Stadium are already occupied, they can't move up as well as they want to in the stadium seating pecking order. It's a mess. The people who do this for a living, honestly, that's not a job I'd want. There are a lot of jobs around UGA that are probably pretty fun. Being in charge of distributing the tickets and deciding who gets what and who ranks ahead of whom, that's probably not a job I necessarily want on that. The other thing that I was talking about with Mike that I want to make sure I address with you is the 24/7 sports report that Steve Sarkisian kind of latched onto about the number of five stars that they've put in the first round of the NFL draft. Now, it stands to reason if you have more five stars, which Alabama has, you're going to have a greater number that get drafted, because almost anybody else below Alabama has had almost too low of a sample size to really make much extrapolation on. It's hard to say if you've only had a small handful of five stars, you didn't develop yours very well. From the stats alone, we can't determine that. But obviously, no matter how you spin it, when Alabama's batting about 50%, way higher than the rest of the country, in terms of putting five stars in the first round, you got to give them a little bit of credit for that. And I think it does become interesting for Georgia for some of its draft-eligible five stars this year. We mentioned some of these names. Guys like Zamir White, nation's former number one running back. Guys like Jamari Salyer. Guys like Tyson Campbell. Guys like Adam Anderson. How many of those guys can we really see blossom this year and for that future year? The Nolan Smith, N'Kobe Dean, Trayvon Walker's the world, George Pickens. Eventually we'll get a chance to see Clay Webb. You know, what kind of progress do we see from them? For the draft-eligible guys in particular for this year, you know, it may seem like a long leap to put a guy like Zamir into the first round, just given the fact that he was, you know, lightly used a year ago, but he's another year removed from injury. Georgia's obviously had a bit of a history of putting first-round running backs together, and as I said before, he brings the credentials of at one point in time being viewed as the nation's number one running back coming out of high school. Not a dramatic leap necessarily, in other words. Same for Jamari Salyer. We think of him as maybe playing out of position this year, tackle, as opposed to guard, but that's not all that different than the scenario that Isaiah Wynn dealt with in 2017, when he also may be playing out of position, told that he was too small to be a tackle, became a first-round pick of the New England Patriots. So not a wild leap to say that Salyer could have huge growth this year. And I would say the one to watch maybe Tyson Campbell there as well, because I think quietly when Campbell was healthy last season, he showed a good bit of development from where he had been as a freshman in 2018, showed a good bit of development, and I think he was playing really well. The experience he gained in 2018, even though it wasn't always necessarily the top-end performance as a freshman, I think it helped him last year. And I think the Georgia fans who may have allowed Campbell to become out of sight, out of mind because he's been hurt, they may be in for a pleasant surprise this upcoming season. My SEC through music has ended. I had some SEC stories I wanted to get through. Let me just try to rattle through these a little bit. I was going to talk about what Heather Dinich said about the coronavirus stuff. She was on First Take saying that she thought the chances of playing a normal season full schedule in the fall was decreasing by the day. I think she's wrong on that. Maybe at some point in time I'll get into why I think she's wrong. I won't pretend to know exactly what's happening on this, but I think that, to me, the overwhelming trend has been in the right direction for those who want, you know, college football coming up in the fall. So I'll leave that at that for right now. I think that Dinich, the way that her words have been quoted, probably a little bit of a mischaracterization of the exact situation on the ground, but we'll probably talk about that at some point, other point in time. Let me do a couple of other football things instead. I think this is interesting. I've been saying now for a while on the basis of Tennessee, who's had, you know, pretty big week when it comes to recruiting and gotten a lot of attention for it, that I thought Tennessee would recruit better earlier than they did, and I thought they might struggle on the field. And the truth is, the exact opposite has been true. They were better on the field last season than I would have assumed, but even though over the course of the last couple of cycles they've gotten a lot of high-profile visits, they haven't signed very many of those elite prospects. They had probably been doing a little worse in recruiting than I assumed they would. Now it seems like that trend's completely reversed itself in the other direction. Tennessee's clearly doing better in recruiting than they had been doing, you know, bringing in a lot of attention for the early work that's gone on here in the mix for five stars in a way that you would not have seen Jeremy Pruitt's classes be in the mix before. But as I've been saying to you, I think that may be coupled with a bit of a downgrade on the field compared to where the Vols were last season. And some people had asked me what I meant by that. So I did some homework on this. Let me give you some numbers. So if you look at the preseason projections that are out there right now, FPI, the Football Power Index from ESPN, only has Tennessee at 6.3 wins for the upcoming season. They're over under, a number that you can bet more or fewer wins than. DraftKings has Tennessee at 7, and Caesars Palace has the Vols at 7.5. So the early projections have Tennessee somewhere between 6 and 7.5 wins for the upcoming season. That'd be kind of a disappointment, even against some pretty tough opponents for this upcoming year. If Tennessee's just 6-6 or 7-5 in the regular season, Vols fans would not be too happy about that compared to all the talk that's been going on here this offseason. Let me dive a little deeper on this. I mentioned the Football Power Index, which is not always a perfect projection for a season, but it's at least a data point worth considering. FPI actually favors South Carolina versus Tennessee, a game I had already told you to watch out for if you were the Vols. FPI only makes Tennessee a 5-point favorite against Arkansas. Keep that in mind. And essentially chooses the Kentucky game as a toss-up, giving the Vols about a 52% chance of winning it. All things being equal, that's not very impressive. And if you're curious how Football Power Index favors Georgia against Tennessee, it gives Georgia about a 92% chance of winning that game. So keep that in mind that, as I've said before, the recruiting momentum seems to be going in the right direction for Tennessee, maybe a little slower than I first thought it would, given all the early playing time Tennessee had to sell. But on-field momentum, that may actually take a step back this upcoming year. Some potential good news for Auburn. Former Virginia Tech commit Demetrius Davis has decommitted. He's actually from North Shore High School. That's Zach Evans' old high school. That's a big-time target for Auburn, and he's back on the open market decommitting from Virginia Tech. So watch out for Auburn with a pretty big-name 2021 quarterback, Demetrius Davis, on that front. Anything else? I may have to do more on this tomorrow. So there's an interesting Louisiana TV report. Jacques Doucet is the reporter on this, quoting Matt Mauch, who was the quarterback that won a national championship with Nick Saban at LSU in 2003. They're talking about his relationship with Saban. This is like one of those things you see a lot on TV right now. Basically, sports departments trying to figure out some way to fill time. So you go back and interview the old legends, Mauch included. And in the interview, Mauch basically talked about how little of a relationship that he had with Nick Saban, not just now in his post-playing career, but even when he was a player, that Saban essentially never gave him the time of day, never looked him in the eye, never had much to say to him whatsoever. It is not a flattering portrayal of Nick Saban. And I've said this a million times before. I think that if you're looking to negatively recruit against Saban, this is the place you look to go to do that. Because even the other day in some things that Tua Tagovailoa was quoted as saying, that when he first got to Alabama, his relationship with Saban was pretty slow to develop as well. There were some reports out there that kind of said that. You know, Saban does not come across as this sort of warm and fuzzy guy necessarily. It's one of the reasons why I think Scott Cochran's departure from Alabama has gotten so much attention from within Tuscaloosa. Because what Saban wasn't, Cochran always was. And the soft skills, the people skills, were always covered as long as you had Cochran, as Mike Johnson and others on our show have described him as, the coach of the offseason. Alabama players could always feel warm and fuzzy. But with Cochran gone, and if Nick Saban is now more fully the face of the program, how much of that is there really? He's obviously been a great coach. Sometimes I wonder how good of a guy he is, and the relationship with some of his former players may leave you wondering some of that there as well. Nonetheless, Gator Hater Updater here on Dog Nation Daily, presented by Meriwether and Tharp. 1,286 days. That's how long it's been since those lousy, stinking Gators have beaten the Georgia Bulldogs. We'll see you tomorrow, Dog Nation Daily, presented by Meriwether and Tharp.